Silently, they looked to the back of the room and saw a flustered-looking nun standing next to Bishop Galbraith. A moment passed, then all five of them started frantically explaining all at once. The bishop listened to the unintelligible chatter for a moment before shouting,
"This is the Lord's house, and I am his representative here on earth, and I swear if you don't all shut up and behave yourselves, I will see to it that you meet him personally."
They all went to Bishop Galbraith's quarters to discuss things like mature adults, because an older authority figure had ordered them to.
"Why on earth did you decide to take a hostage?"
Gwen asked.
"Oh, I know Donnie. He's a good guy. He just got caught up in the wrong crowd. Isn't that right, Donnie?"
Donnie nodded a little too quickly, as if he thought he might still be caught up in the wrong crowd.
"Well, now you're free of him," Martin said.
"Lie low for a few hours, then go home. If Kluge or any of his friends ever shows up asking questions, tell them that we were flying low over some trees and you jumped for it and hid. Then tell them that you don't want to hang around with them anymore because not one of them lifted a finger to rescue you."
"But what if they're out there trying to save me right now?"
Donnie asked. After a long silence, he said,
"Yeah, right. Never mind."
Donnie thanked the wizards, made his excuses, and got out of there. After he left, Bishop Galbraith gave Martin a look that said,
"I'm impressed, but don't expect me to ever tell you that."
With the hostage issue off the table, the next order of business was explaining to Bishop Galbraith why they were there. He sat behind his desk as they stood, like naughty children meeting with the principal. They explained what Gwen had found in Rikard's Bend, and how she had brought the others in to have a look. They told him how they had ended up in the clutches of Kluge and his band of oafs. They glossed over who had teleported them to the church. They all knew it was best to discuss that when the bishop was not around. Instead, they discussed why they'd come to the church at all.
"It seemed like the safest place to hide out and come up with a plan,"
Gwen explained.
"On account of churches having to offer sanctuary,"
Jeff said.
"I don't have to offer you anything, son,"
the bishop snorted.
"It's the last place Kluge would ever come looking for us," Gwen said.
"Yep, 'cause the church hates us wizards,"
Jeff said.
"I do not hate, boy. Not wizards or anyone else. Though there are some wizards that I dislike. More so by the minute,"
the bishop replied.
"No, Kluge won't come looking for you here at my church, because doing so would mean coming to my church, and he'll look everywhere else before he resorts to that. Besides, I expect you don't plan to stay here very long."
"You're right," Martin said.
"Rikard's Bend has to be dealt with. We've got to figure out exactly who did that and how we can stop them from doing it again."
It was clear, even to the bishop, who hadn't even been there, that the mass killing at Rikard's Bend was the work of a wizard. Martin and Gary had remained silent about their speculation that someone was trying to make hobbits.
"So then,"
Bishop Galbraith said,
"is there a wizard any of you know who is capable of this? Someone who's secretive? Some wizard who is probably in this area and has had time to himself to do something of this scale?"
Gwen and the bishop were silent. They had nothing to say. Martin, Jeff, and Gary were also silent. They had something they didn't want to say. They looked at the floor. They looked at each other. They looked at Gwen and the bishop. Gwen and the bishop looked back at them, and they quickly looked at the floor. The bishop bared his teeth and blurted,
"Out with it!"
Martin sighed and reluctantly said,
"Well, there's Philip."
An eternity seemed to pass. The room was silent. The only sound was a faint, distant dog snarling at something. Martin wondered if there were any friendly dogs in this town. Finally, the bishop spoke.
"Well, it's clearly not Philip. Who else?"
Martin, Gary, and Jeff shrugged at each other. Martin said,
"I don't want to believe it either."
"Good,"
Bishop Galbraith said.
"I give you permission not to. Who else could it be?"
Martin said,
"Philip fits perfectly. He lives nearby. He's as powerful a wizard as anybody. He has a whole floor of his shop that nobody's allowed to see. He disappears up there and refuses to talk about what he does. I hate to say it, but it fits."
Gwen gave Martin a long, penetrating look before saying,
"He's right." Martin was relieved.
It's not Philip, Gwen continued. Who else could it be?
Martin reflected on the fact that his feelings of relief were increasingly fleeting.
Look, Martin said, I'm not saying Philip did it.
Nobody is, so let's move on,
the bishop said.
But, Martin said, we have to rule him out.
Fine, he's ruled out. Who else could have done it?
The bishop said. Martin sputtered uselessly for a moment, then composed himself.
I don't want to think that Philip did this. I don't believe he did this, but we have to be sure.
I am sure, the bishop said. I've known Philip for 10 years. That's a lot longer than I've known any of you.
The bishop paused and looked at Gwen.
Actually, I've known you a little longer than that, haven't I?
She replied,
something like that,
and actively avoided eye contact with anyone.
Well, I've known Philip a long time, and while I don't like what you wizards do, I like Philip. I trust Philip. I know he'd never hurt another person, and he'd never take the chance of accidentally hurting another person. And if you, his apprentice, don't understand that, then I have to wonder if I can have the same faith in you. Now, if you ask me, and I notice you haven't, I'd say you take a good long look at that weasel Merlin up in Camelot. He can't be trusted.
Martin wasn't surprised to hear Merlin slash Jimmy's name slash names brought up, but he didn't think much of it. Jimmy was capable of wrongdoing, but only small, silly wrongdoing. He was far too obvious a villain to try to get away with anything truly sinister. No, this was obviously the work of the last person you'd suspect, and that meant they had to investigate Philip. Martin looked around the room for support and found none. The bishop was yelling at him. Gwen was glaring at him. Gary and Jeff were silently staring at the floor. Even the angry dog in the distance seemed to be growling louder.
Listen to me, Martin said. I know that Philip would never deliberately hurt another person, even if that person was trying to hurt him. It's not in him. But he is human, Father. We wizards are only human. And it's entirely possible that Philip has made a mistake. I don't think he has, but none of us can honestly say that we know he hasn't. And if we don't at least go and ask him, everyone in this room will always wonder. And that's not fair to Philip.
In the long silence that followed, Martin noted that everyone in the room seemed to have gotten angrier, which he took as a sign that he had won the argument. 24. Although he had been argued into submission, Bishop Galbraith refused to take part in confronting Philip, so the wizards set out for the shop on foot. They could have flown or teleported, but it was only a short walk, and none of them, even Martin, was looking forward to getting there. Gwen was in front, and to the outward observer would have appeared to be leading. In reality, she didn't want to walk with the others, and was trying to put some distance between herself and them, which can be a form of leadership. They walked in terse silence. The only attempt at conversation did not go well. Martin quickened his pace to catch up with Gwen, and in a hushed voice asked, in as non-accusatory a manner as he could,
"So why didn't you tell anyone you were a wizard?"
She answered,
I figured anyone who really deserved to know could figure it out on their own.
It wasn't worded to be a specific criticism of Martin, but he took it as one, and he wasn't wrong.
But Gwen, if you're deliberately hiding something, you can't be mad at me for not finding it. You have to give a guy some clue.
Gwen stopped dead in her tracks, causing Martin to step out in front of her, then stop awkwardly. Gwen looked at Martin's dazzling reflective silver robe, the robe she made for him, then looked him in the eye and said,
Plastic sequins were invented in the 1960s.
Gary laughed. Gwen started walking again, faster and angrier than before. Martin watched as she left, and as Gary and Jeff walked past, he looked down at his robe, let out a heaving sigh, and followed behind. Finally, they reached Philip's shop. They entered, filing into the decoy storefront. Martin knew that they'd be unable to enter the next room, with the rune-covered drapes and the crystal, unless Philip was in there already. So he was not surprised when he tried to push through the curtain and found it as immovable as a brick wall. Martin yelled Philip's name a few times. There was no sound.
Gary attempted to call Philip on the magic hand phone and got no answer. Martin said he'd check to see if Philip was at home. He disappeared, then a few seconds later he reappeared, shaking his head.
No, not there. He's got to be upstairs.
The four of them just stared at each other in impotent silence until Gwen rolled her eyes, looked at the ceiling, and yelled,
"Philip! It's Gwen! They know I'm a wizard!"
A moment passed. Then they heard Philip's muffled voice say,
"I'll be right down!"
"Philip knew?"
Martin asked. Gwen said,
"He's not an idiot."
There was some crashing and banging from upstairs, then the sound of heavy, annoyed footsteps coming down the stairs. Finally, Philip emerged through the curtains into the shop. He nodded to Gwen and said hello. Then he turned to Martin and asked,
"What tipped you off? It was the sequins, right?"
Gary laughed, and Martin turned on him.
"You didn't figure it out either."
"Yeah, but I didn't really care enough to try."
Gwen asked Martin,
"What's your excuse?"
Martin turned back to Philip.
"No, it wasn't the sequins. It was when she saved us by scaring off the thug who was threatening to torture us to death."
Philip looked at Gwen, who nodded.
"Yeah? I suppose that'd be a bit of a tip-off. How'd they get your staffs away from you?"
"They crept up and pummeled us from behind," Jeff said.
Gary added,
"We were a bit distracted by all the corpses."
They went on to describe how Gwen had found the now-defunct village of Rikard's Bend and brought in the other three while still trying to maintain her secret. They told Philip about their many attempts to reach him and their arrival at Rikard's Bend. They described in great detail the condition of the bodies they found, the stunted limbs, the lack of shoes. Philip shook his head slightly and muttered,
"Hobbits."
"Yes, clearly hobbits," Gwen said.
Martin was surprised, since neither he nor Gary had mentioned this theory to her. Then he made a mental note that he needed to stop acting surprised when Gwen knew things. By this time, they had all moved into the crystal ballroom and were sitting around the table. Martin noted that the Commodore 64 was not in its usual spot on the secret shelf in front of Philip's seat, which meant Philip was using it elsewhere, most likely upstairs. Philip ran his fingers through his hair and said,
"Okay, so this is awful. We have a wizard somewhere who tried to turn an entire village into hobbits, killing everyone in the process. We'll have to work together to deal with this. Any suggestions as to what we should do now?"
Gary, Jeff, and Martin looked at each other. Gwen looked at the table in front of her. Martin steeled himself and said,
"I think the logical first step, Philip, would be for you to tell us what you're doing upstairs."
After a predictable amount of shocked, angry stammering, Philip downshifted into angry, offended yelling.
"You can't honestly think I would do something like this! I'd never dream of such a thing!"
"I told him you didn't do it,"
Gwen said.
"And I agreed," Martin said. "But you're clearly up to something, and a whole village is dead. Think about that, Philip. You didn't have to look at it like we did, so take a second to internalize it. An entire village of innocent people, killed in one stroke, and it was clearly done by a wizard who was trying to turn them into hobbits. We wizards have to police each other because nobody else can do it. You're the one who taught me that."
"Oh, I taught you that, did I? Not surprising, since I taught you everything."
Philip's voice rose to a high, wounded whine. His eyes looked like they might pop out of his head.
"Martin, I took you in! I'm the best friend you have! I'm your bloody mentor! Does it really seem likely that I'd be a mass murderer?"
"No, Phil, it seems highly unlikely. That's why we have to consider it. You could say that you're the last person I'd ever suspect."
Philip shook his head.
"Oh, Martin, is that it? I seem too nice and too harmless, so I must be hiding some sinister secret, like we're nothing but two-dimensional characters in some bad novel."
"I genuinely hope not," Martin said.
"Yeah, I bet. Look, kid, what I do upstairs is my business, and that's just going to have to be good enough for you. Now get out of my shop!"
Philip rose and pointed at the door. Martin did not stand, nor did any of the others.
Martin spoke in a low, sad tone.
Philip, I really am sorry. I don't for a second believe that you would do this, but I'm not the only person who has noticed that you disappear upstairs and refuse to talk about what you're doing up there.
I disappear into the bathroom and I don't want to talk about what I do in there. Does that mean I'm doing something wrong in there, too?
Martin kept his voice flat but arched his eyebrows.
Do you really want to discuss your bathroom?
Philip sat down hard in his seat. He looked around the table.
If I kick you lot out of here, you're just going to go to Jimmy, aren't you?
We don't want to, Martin said.
Philip sneered and shifted his focus to Gary, who shrugged and said,
Just show us what you're up to, man. We won't tell everyone. We'll just take a peek, then we can get on with finding who did this.
Jeff said,
We'll be in and out. We won't touch nothing. We'll be like a cool breeze blowing through your attic.
Philip looked at Gwen, who was still looking at the table. He asked her,
What do you think?
She lifted her gaze and looked him in the eye.
I think you should show us what you've been up to and be done with it.
Philip shook his head.
You know what's sad? I was almost ready to show you anyway.
Philip led them through the curtain and up the stairs. The steps were dark, rough-hewn, unfinished wood. The outer wall was unfinished stone. The inner wall was wood. The first five steps led to a landing where the staircase bent 90 degrees to the right. The first few steps, those that might be seen from the curtains, were the same as those before, but beyond that it was too dark to see. Philip stopped, looked at Martin, sighed in an exasperated manner, then flipped a plastic light switch on the wall. Once his eyes had adjusted, Martin could see that the remainder of the steps were a beautiful long-grained hardwood that had been treated with some sort of finish which had made them glossy and turned them the color of honey. The outer wall was still stone, but the inner was slightly off-white plaster, with a subtle bumpy texture. Philip continued up the stairs. The others followed. As their heads rose above the level of the floor, they were able to see the room they were entering. It took a moment to fully comprehend what they were seeing. The entire upstairs was one large room. The floor was covered in the same beautifully finished hardwood as the stairs. Tasteful track lighting and a skylight illuminated clean, white plaster walls. A sofa made of chrome and white leather sat near a black leather lounge chair and matching footrest. Between them was a coffee table made of glass and whitewashed concrete. The walls were decorated with a palm tree rendered in neon and thin black frames supporting angular paintings of beautiful women with smooth white skin, thick black hair, and perfect bodies. There was also a stereo the size of a small kitchen appliance with speakers as tall as Martin and a full-sized arcade cabinet that said Gorf. Philip made a beeline for the corner where a small glass and concrete dining table and chairs sat next to a built-in wet bar. Philip pulled the cap out of a bottle of whiskey and poured himself a drink without offering one to anyone else. Gary whistled and said,
I'm totally doing my cave up like this.
Philip said,
Well, be sure to let Martin know what you're up to, or you might get accused of mass murder.
Martin took no notice. He was preoccupied by what he saw beyond the seating area. A large roll-up door was built into the wall. In the corner, there was a work table with the Commodore 64, modem, and tiny TV displaying the file. In front of the door sat a nearly mint-condition white Pontiac Fiero. Nearly mint because the taillights were not fully assembled. A set of screwdrivers and a drinking glass with screws lying in the bottom told Martin exactly what Philip had been doing when they demanded that he come downstairs. Martin approached the Fiero. It was smaller than he remembered them, but then he hadn't seen one since he was a child. He slowly circled the car, drinking in all of its contours. He bent a look in the window like a teenager peering into the interior of a floor sample at a Ferrari dealership. It looked complete and pristine. Martin knew there were limits on what could be transported back in time. His flimsy kid bed mattress was about the upper limit of what was possible. Clearly, Philip had painstakingly disassembled his beloved car, transported the parts here piece by piece, and reassembled it with great care. More care than was probably taken when it was assembled in the first place. Martin stood up and looked at Philip, who was still behind the bar on the far end of the room. This is amazing, he said. Why didn't you tell me? I could have helped.
Philip said,
That's the point. I wanted to do it myself. There's a certain pride in looking at something big and complex and knowing you did it without help.
Even if Martin could argue with that, he wouldn't have. A minute ago, seeing what was in this room had seemed like the most important thing in the world. He was willing to suffer any consequences to make it happen. Now he had seen what was here, and it was great, far better than anything he had hoped, and infinitely superior to what he'd feared. Now all that was left was to deal with the fallout and try to repair the damage. Looking at Philip and the faces of his friends, he saw how much damage was done. In that moment, Martin couldn't imagine what he'd been thinking just a few moments before. Gary was sitting in the lounge chair. Gwen sat on the couch. Jeff was studying the Gorf machine with great intensity. None of them were looking at Philip. Martin had taken the lead in making the mess. He'd have to take the lead in cleaning it up. He walked around the nose of the car and slowly approached the bar. Philip watched him silently, holding the glass of whiskey in his hand. When Martin reached the bar, Philip silently reached beneath the bar and pulled out another glass. He glanced at Martin and poured a second glass of Jack Daniels. He picked up the glass, looked Martin in the eye, then quickly downed it himself. He sneered at Martin as he slammed the empty glass down on the bar. Martin said,
I think I speak for everyone when I say that we're sorry we did this.
I know I am, Philip said.
But Philip, you get it, right? Martin continued. I mean, I know you're mad, and you've got good reason, but you see why we had to do this.
No. Honestly, Martin, I don't. I don't understand why you couldn't take my word. All of you, I mean, okay, Martin's only known me a little while, but I've known all of you for years. I thought we were all friends. But the first time someone kills 100 or so people, you lot are the first to turn up at my door with pitchforks.
Gwen turned on the couch to look at Philip.
None of us wanted to believe it, Philip, but you're the only one we knew who was keeping a secret.
Philip smiled as he said,
Really? Gwen? I'm the only one you know who is keeping a secret.
Gwen flushed and quickly turned away.
You're the only one we knew who was obviously keeping a secret, Jeff offered.
Philip looked poised to yell some more, but stopped. Instead, he finished his first drink, looked into the empty glass for a moment, and said,
You mean I'm the only one who is keeping a secret badly?
Well, Martin said, It isn't easy when you've got some jerk living with you.
Agreed.
Jeff turned away from the Gorf machine.
Oh, come on, Philip. That isn't fair. We all thought...
Philip put up a hand to signal surrender and silence Jeff.
We can argue about that later. We have more important business. Somewhere there's a wizard who's killed innocent people... And now that we know who it isn't, we have to figure out who it is.
So, Martin asked, what do we do now?
As much as it pains me, Philip said, I think we have to go tell Jimmy.
None of them seemed happy with the prospect. Philip was the only one who was openly hostile toward Jimmy, but Martin was Jimmy's biggest fan in the room, and even he would describe his attitude toward Jimmy as wary. Nobody spoke. The only sound was a distant dog growling.
Man, Martin said, what is the deal with that dog?
I know, right? How long can a dog growl before it just says forget it? Jeff said.
Gary laughed.
It's all garar, arar, grrr, like all the time.
How long have you been hearing it? Gwen asked. I heard a dog growling back in Rickard's Bend, but it can't be the same dog, can it?
Philip shook his head in disgust.
Oh, yes. Proper bunch of detectives you are.
He hastily grabbed his staff, which had been leaning in the corner behind the bar, and stepped around the end of the bar, across the room, to an empty patch of floor in front of the Fiero. He planted the tip of his staff on the floor, then with his other hand pointed to the spot where the staff intersected with the floor. He cast his eyes around the room, then said in a loud, clear voice,
Okay, stand here and stay there until I say to move.
Martin started walking toward the spot to do as he was told, but stopped dead when Philip glared at him and shook his head. Philip pulled his staff away and slowly backed off from the spot he'd indicated as if it were radioactive. In three quick steps, he was at his computer. With his left hand, he pointed his staff at the spot he'd indicated. With the other, he typed some commands. A few excruciating moments passed, with nothing but the sound of clacking keys and Philip muttering. Finally, Philip's shoulders slumped and the muttering gave way to cursing. He looked at the empty spot on the floor and said, "Hold on, just another second," then typed in another command and hit enter. Tyler appeared, gasping for air, eyes bulging. He immediately fell to his knees. Gary and Gwen had watched with interest, but now they leapt to their feet. Jeff abandoned the arcade console and ran to where Tyler, breathing deeply and moaning, knelt on the floor. Philip pulled off his hat, said,
"Embote ligita, aquo,"
and produced a bottle of mineral water. He handed it to Tyler, who gulped it down at an astonishing rate. Martin remembered his first morning in medieval England, when Philip told him the do's and don'ts of wizarding, particularly the part about getting ghosted, being made invisible. You didn't need food, air, or water, but your body didn't know it. You could still see and hear. You could still move around, but you couldn't interact with anything heavier than a mote of dust floating in the air. The real torture was that you couldn't talk, but you could make faint, spooky noises. So any attempt at communicating would only torment and repel those you tried to contact. Martin knew Tyler had been missing for at least a week. Starving, suffocating, and dying of thirst for a week, surrounded by people who would love to help him, but didn't know he needed help. Martin couldn't imagine anything worse. Tyler finished the bottle of water. He remained kneeling on the floor, breathing deeply. He opened his eyes, reached out, and took Philip's staff. He said,
"Mi banchambro,"
Esperanto for "my bathroom," and disappeared. Yep, Martin thought. That's worse. They sat in a sullen, guilty silence while they waited for Tyler's return. Philip poured everyone a drink. Finally, Tyler reappeared. Nobody said a word, nor would they until Tyler broke the silence. He walked to Philip, who was standing by the bar. He handed Philip's staff back to him, then hugged him for a very long time. Finally, Tyler released the hug and said,
"Thank you."
Tyler turned to the rest of the group who were seated, but stood up as soon as Tyler returned. Tyler nodded to Gwen and said,
"Gwen, a pleasure as always."
She returned his greeting. He turned to Gary and Jeff, his two best friends, and in a genuine outpouring of heartfelt emotion said,
"Damn you idiots, you morons! I'm so mad at you two!"
Clearly, words alone couldn't express what he was feeling. He shouted inarticulate rage noises at Gary and Jeff for a while longer. By the time he was done, Philip had produced another bottle of water, which he handed to Tyler. Tyler sat heavily on the couch and took a drink.
"I've been growling at you idiots for 12 days,
Tyler said between gulps of water.
"You both read my book. I'd hope spooky growling would make you think of me at least once in all that time."
Martin turned to Gwen and said in a low voice,
"Tyler's an author. He wrote a book called The Curse of the Ghost of the Wolfman's Mummy. The monster would make a spooky growling noise."
Gwen nodded and said,
"I know. I've read it. Philip loaned me a copy."
That meant that Martin was the only one in the room who hadn't read the book. He thought,
"I really do have to stop assuming that Gwen doesn't know things."
Tyler turned to Martin, fresh anger in his eyes.
"And you, the new kid, you looked right at me twice. I know you saw me. One time you were so scared you fell out of your stupid hammock."
"That was you?"
Martin said.
"Yes, Martin. The ghostly apparition trying desperately to get Philip's attention was me. I'd given up on ever getting through to Ren and Stimpy over here, and thought I'd try to get the attention of the one sensible adult I know. Thanks again for finally saving me, Philip."
"You're welcome,"
Philip said as he settled into the lounge chair.
"I'm just sorry it took us so long."
They all apologized, even Gwen, who hadn't really done anything. Tyler waved his hand dismissively, which was as close to an apology accepted as they were likely to get. Martin pulled a bar stool over and had a seat. Gary and Jeff followed suit. Gwen sat on the lounge chair's matching footrest. After what he'd gone through, the least they could do was let Tyler have the couch.
So, Philip said, how'd it happen?
Tyler told them that he'd gone to Rickard's Bend to do some more research for the fantasy novel he was working on. When he got there, he bumped into Jimmy. Jimmy had asked why he was there and had reacted with great interest when he learned that Tyler was writing a novel. They talked about the books they'd read and the movies they'd seen. Finally, Jimmy had told Tyler that he had a project he was working on and that he would welcome Tyler's opinion. There were several knowing looks at this. Even Jimmy's greatest detractors had to admit that he was not without his talents, and one of them was making whoever he was talking to feel like the most important, talented, and valuable person Jimmy had ever met. Tyler continued, telling them how he went to Camelot with Jimmy, and how Jimmy showed him plans to gradually remake the people of Rickard's Bend into hobbits.
He asked me if I had any input as an author, Tyler said. I told him he was a monster. And that's when he ghosted you? Philip asked. Oh, yeah. He ghosted me but good. I turned my back to walk away and he flew up behind me, pressed his staff to my back and said the words. At first all I could do was struggle to breathe. I felt like I was dying nonstop until I got acclimated.
How long did that take? Martin asked.
Hours. I don't know how many. Then I got used to it.
Gwen said,
it's a good thing the craving for air gets better.
I didn't say it got better, Tyler said. I just got used to it.
They all considered this for as long as they dared. Martin broke the silence, turning to Philip and asking,
what do we do now?
Philip stood. He looked at the other wizards and said,
we take Jimmy down. We'd better call everybody and get them up to speed. We want to do this right. And by right, I mean in as public and humiliating a manner as possible.
25. 30 minutes later, the clearing beneath Skull Gullet Cave was full of wizards. They had called every wizard in Europe except Jimmy and Eddie, a.k.a. Wing Po. They'd excluded Jimmy for obvious reasons. They had no direct evidence that Eddie was involved, but they had no evidence that he wasn't either, and they chose not to risk telling him. They kept it quiet by telling everyone they were planning a surprise for Jimmy, which Philip pointed out with palpable glee was true. Skull Gullet Cave was chosen for the meeting because it was large enough to accommodate everyone, and the mouth of the skull made a fine amphitheater. Philip stood in front, because he was the most well-known and respected wizard present. Next to Gwen, to explain that she was a wizard and to tell what she had found in Rickard's Bend. Tyler, to explain about Rickard's Bend and to tell about his ghosting. And Gary, because he insisted, and it was his cave. As the wizards started arriving, Martin found a quiet moment to speak with Gwen privately. He leaned in close.
Gwen, can I ask you a question?
Gwen tensed, but said,
yes.
Martin bit his lip, then asked,
in your salutation, how did you throw that lummox off of you like that? That was really, really cool. I considered trying to do something like that in mine, but I couldn't figure out an elegant way to program it. You'd have to differentiate between you, your belongings, and the person you want to repel. I just can't figure out how you did it.
Gwen smiled and actually laughed a bit.
It's actually really simple. You know the exclusion zones we use to seal off certain places? They only act on people, and you can make them not apply to yourself, right? Well, I make a cone-shaped exclusion zone underground beneath my feet. Then I make it move up over my head really fast, and any person who isn't me but is standing inside the radius of the cone gets thrown off.
Martin stared at her, mouth agape. She thought he was amazed, and that was part of it. He was also tremendously turned on.
Wow, he said. That's so simple. It just never occurred to me. Really, nice work.
He couldn't think of anything else to do, so he shook her hand. He started to walk away, then turned back to face her.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure,
she said.
What year are you from?
She laughed again.
2014. Born in 92.
Martin smiled.
Huh. So I'm a little older than you.
She shook her head.
I've been here for 10 years, so technically I'm older than you. I was just born later.
Martin smiled again.
Huh. That's right, isn't it? Cool.
He turned and walked down to the clearing. Glenn watched him go. Martin and Jeff stood in the clearing with the rest of the wizards. Philip thanked everyone for coming, apologized for the false pretenses, and promised them that they'd all understand why it was necessary soon enough. He started by announcing that Gwen was a wizard.
I told all of you that I was the first one to show up in this time and place, but that's not quite true. Gwen, whom you all know, since she made all of your robes, had already been here for a month when I showed up. She swore me and Jimmy to secrecy because a female wizard is called a witch, and the locals have something of an attitude about witches.
Heads nodded in agreement. One voice at the back said something about her weighing the same as a duck, but nobody was in the mood. Philip opened the floor for questions about Gwen's wizardiness before moving on to business. Most of the questions centered on her tailoring business. She explained that she took measurements and made patterns the old-fashioned way, but went to the future to buy fabric. Also on harder sewing jobs, she'd use a sewing machine. She had the powers of a wizard, the standing in the community of a craftsman, and the freedom to walk the streets without people asking her to magic their problems away. It was all quite lovely, until Rikard's Bend. Her description of what she found there sucked all of the air out of the room. She told the story of how she had brought Martin, Jeff, and Gary out to have a look, and she explained that she'd had to break her cover to get them away from Kluge's gang. She concluded by saying that it was clear to them that the villagers were killed by a wizard, and that the wizard had embarked on a secret plan to make hobbits. This comment produced several raised hands. Gwen called on one of the Norwegian death metal wizards.
He stammered, stalling a bit. Sorry, but I have to ask, Philip, what have you been doing upstairs in your shop?
Philip bit his lip. Gary announced,
We already checked on that. He's been transporting and assembling a car, one piece at a time.
Most of the hands went down. Philip made eye contact with Martin, who could only shrug. Gary continued,
It's a Pontiac Fiero.
The rest of the hands went down. The wizards from Italy tried to hide their amusement, but not very hard. Philip explained briefly that the others had come to him, and that during that conversation they figured out what had happened to Tyler. Philip turned the floor over to Tyler, who just barely managed to keep his composure as he told the assembled wizards how he learned Jimmy's plan and was ghosted for it. That was all it took. By the time he was done, everyone present was of a like mind. There was some discussion, but the consensus was that Jimmy had violated the only three rules they had. He had altered people's physical structure. He had done so on helpless locals who had not given their consent, and he had used his power to ghost Tyler, which everyone agreed was unspeakably cruel without really having to discuss it. Philip summed up.
So, we know what was done, and we know by whom. We can't let this stand. If we don't stop him, we're just as responsible as he is. We have to go to London, confront Jimmy, and put an end to this once and for all. We must police ourselves, because no one else can. We'll give him an opportunity to explain himself. I doubt he'll have a valid excuse, because I can't imagine what a valid excuse would be. More likely he'll try to fight us, but he can't possibly ghost everyone. And if he manages to get a few of us, the rest can neutralize him and undo the damage. It's not going to be easy,
Philip continued.
Many of you like Jimmy, and it's going to be hard for you to take him down. I despise him, and as such, I will have a hard time pretending not to enjoy every second of his downfall and humiliation. That's my burden to bear.
The sun was high in the sky, and in the splendid courtyard in front of the Golden Palace of Camelot, people were going about their daily business. Workmen worked. Guards guarded, and everyone was squinting, as was their custom on a sunny day. The light reflecting off of the golden castle Camelot, the giant gold-covered gates, the massive golden statue of the old king, the young king, and the wizard who advised them, and the polished gold adornments on the staff's uniforms combined to give the impression that to be at Camelot Castle was to stand in the center of the sun. People's vision was so impaired by the unceasing glare that most of them didn't even notice when 23 wizards, wearing sunglasses, suddenly appeared out of nowhere, linked hand to shoulder like a sideways conga line. The wizards separated themselves from one another and strode purposefully to the castle's entrance. Philip and Tyler in the lead, flanked by Martin, Gwen, Gary, and Jeff. Martin asked Philip,
"So, what's the plan?"
"I'm gonna win," Philip said. "I'm finally gonna beat him, and I'm gonna taste his defeat. Then I'm gonna chew his defeat. Then I'm gonna open my mouth wide and make him look at his gross chewed-up defeat, and he will be disgusted by it, as I am by him."
"Damn right," Tyler added, "and I think I might kick him in the nuts."
Martin considered this and said,
"Good. I'm glad we have a solid plan."
The castle had no door, as such. The massive open archway led to the opulent antechamber, which in turn led to the great hall. Guards in gold-encrusted uniforms flanked the gold-encrusted arch, defending it with gold-encrusted swords. The guards made no move to prevent the wizards from entering. Philip sneered at them as he walked through the arch and ran face first into the invisible field that kept any wizard from entering the castle without Jimmy's permission. Tyler, Martin, and Gwen also walked into the field. The other wizards walked into them or each other. Over the sound of grumbling and cursing, one of the guards said,
"Merlin is expecting you. Please wait here and you'll be escorted to his chambers."
The wizards spread out, straightening their robes and regaining their dignity as best they could. After a moment, Eddie appeared in the antechamber.
"Gentlemen! Gwen! Welcome to Castle Camelot! Do come in!"
His lack of surprise at seeing Gwen carrying a wand was telling. Martin looked at Gwen askance.
"Eddie knew about you?"
he asked. Gwen was at a loss.
"I didn't tell him."
Eddie had sharp ears. He smiled and said,
"Merlin tells me everything."
Tyler asked,
"Oh, does he?"
About twice as loud as he probably intended. Philip put a steadying hand on Tyler's shoulder. In a dry tone, Philip asked,
"Did he tell you that he killed an entire village full of people?"
Eddie's smile faded. He looked confused. Then his expression soured, and he mumbled,
"Oh, Philip."
He composed himself, then with forced joviality said,
"Merlin will be ready to see you all in a moment. Please, follow me."
The wizard spent the next 10 minutes exploring the most opulent waiting room in all of England. The seats were veritable thrones. Instead of magazines, there were tomes of arcane knowledge, which Martin recognized as books of magic tricks from the early 20th century. Some of them were in English, featuring men in tuxedos holding playing cards and pigeons. Others were in Chinese, and featured men in silk robes holding chrome rings and pigeons. It occurred to Martin that one way or the other, stage magic was the art of manipulating the pigeons. He considered sharing this idea with the other wizards, but he knew nobody was in the mood. While they waited, Eddie sat at a large desk in the corner. When they first arrived, he told the wizards to make themselves comfortable. Then, Eddie held up his right hand to use the magic handphone to make a call, but put his left hand up to his ear as if to press an earpiece. Merlin's flaming M icon appeared in his hand, and Eddie said that the wizards had arrived. Nobody heard the reply. Then, Eddie said in a worried tone that they had said something about killing a village. More silence followed, but Eddie seemed reassured. He ended the call and told the assembled wizards that it would only be a few minutes. After a minute or two, he tried to engage Gary in conversation, but Gary asked him if he was proud to be the world's first receptionist, and with that, Eddie picked up on the ugly mood in the room and stopped talking. 10 minutes later, the large, ornately carved golden doors opened, and Jimmy invited everyone into his office. The wizards angrily stormed into Jimmy's office, but as the door was only wide enough to accommodate 2 wizards at a time, storming in angrily was almost indistinguishable from filing in politely. Although nobody had mentioned it, everyone was waiting to see Jimmy's reaction to Tyler. Everyone expected a satisfying mix of shock and guilt. Everyone was disappointed. Jimmy saw Tyler and took on the attitude of a man who has just bumped into an old friend who he knows has been in the hospital.
"Tyler!" he said. "I'm so glad to see they finally brought you back!"
He looked to Gary and Jeff and rolled his eyes dismissively.
"I always knew they'd get the hint eventually, but I had no idea it'd take them so long. If it had gone on too much longer, I was going to step in and rescue you myself."
Tyler kicked Jimmy in the crotch as hard as he could. The speed and ferocity of it made every man in the room cringe. Every man but Jimmy, who mentioned that he had anticipated this eventuality and had created an exclusionary zone 1 foot in diameter around his genitalia. He explained that no one could get anywhere near that part of his body without his permission. He arched an eyebrow at Gwen. He had to speak up to explain all this over the sound of Tyler grunting with exertion as he fruitlessly kicked Jimmy's nether region over and over again. Finally, after several more kicks, Tyler stopped. Clearly, Jimmy's words had finally sunk in.
"Satisfied?"
Jimmy asked. Tyler kicked him in the shin. Jimmy grimaced in pain, hunched his shoulders, and hopped as he rubbed his bruised shin with his hands.
"For now,"
said Tyler. Jimmy's office was about the size of a tennis court. It had marble floors, gold leaf columns, a high ceiling painted to look like the sky, and large stained glass windows, the standard Jimmy design scheme. In one corner there was a desk, a predictably oversized gold rectangle of hardwood so covered with tiny ornate carvings that from a distance it read as a bumpy popcorn ceiling texture. In another corner there was an equally ornate altar. Clearly this was where Jimmy stood to do magic in the presence of non-wizards. Martin wondered which of these two pieces of furniture hid Jimmy's computer. In the middle of the room there was a large conference table. There was something acutely bumpy in the middle of the table, covered with a sheet that covered the table's entire surface and hung over the sides. Jimmy tried to do his customary glide step over to the conference table, but his newly acquired limp spoiled the effect.
"Gentlemen, Gwen," he said, "I understand that you're all upset. I don't blame you one bit, particularly you, Tyler. I haven't been honest, and I've done more than one thing of which I'm not proud. Mistakes were made, grave mistakes. But I'm confident that when you see why I did it, you'll understand. Please, gather round."
The wizards approached the table. Everyone, even Philip, had intended to give Jimmy the chance to explain. Nobody expected him to be able to justify his actions, but he was entitled to try. Eddie nosed his way through the group to stand next to his best friend and boss.
"As you all know," Jimmy said, "when I first arrived in this time and place, I found primitive conditions and ignorant, superstitious people."
"And me and Gwen,"
Philip added.
"Quite,"
Jimmy agreed.
"And may I say, Gwen, I'm delighted that you finally decided to come out in the open and join the rest of us. Anyway, back when it was just the three of us, we made a sincere effort to keep from exposing the native people of this time to our modern ideas and conveniences. Philip, would you like to tell them how well that worked?"
"They all know that we discovered contamination from time travelers who had gone back even farther than us,"
Philip fumed,
"and that our actions weren't affecting the future. So what?"
Jimmy smiled benevolently.
"So, I decided there was no reason I shouldn't make life better here for everyone. I developed a three-phase plan. Phase one was to introduce little niceties like eating off of plates with forks instead of eating with daggers and stale slabs of bread. I introduced basic sanitation. I was careful to do this in such a way that the natives thought they were inventing it themselves. The castle we're standing in was phase two. I've stabilized the government, raised the kingdom's standard of living, and given the people leaders they can look to with pride."
Jimmy looked intolerably pleased with himself. Eddie also looked intolerably pleased with him. Jimmy continued.
"I had hoped to put off going public with the final phase of the plan, but I'm afraid Tyler forced my hand, which is fine. It's really no problem. I apologize for ghosting you, Tyler, but I had no choice. I still had a couple of details to shore up before I could unveil phase three. Phase three is designed to give the people the life they always wanted instead of the life they always get.
When life gets hard, too hard to face, people often turn to movies, television, or books. We retreat into a world of fantasy. I am going to improve life for every sentient being on Earth by making reality a little more like fantasy. As you all know, Jimmy continued, one of the few truly sacred rules we have is to never alter a living person's physical structure because, of course, you will most likely kill them. However, a few of us have proven, mostly by accident, that if the change is made are small enough, the subject can continue their life unharmed, and in some cases, unaware that anything happened to them at all. I have devised a plan whereby I can use small, incremental changes over a prolonged period of time to improve the physical condition of every man, woman, and child in this country.
Jimmy whipped the sheet off of the table, revealing a three-dimensional relief map of the British Isles. The cities were delineated by small, stylized models blown far out of scale to the land itself to make them stand out better. Camelot was a recognizable golden model of the castle, but most of the other cities, towns, and villages were less recognizable. Jimmy produced a pointer and indicated London, now Camelot, and most of the main island.
In this area, people will remain largely unchanged. I have a plan to make them a bit taller, more muscular, and overall healthier, but there will be no drastic changes. This area will be the Kingdom of Man.
Jimmy pointed to a small area near the border with Scotland.
As we all know, this area has many rather dense forests. I have chosen this area to be the Kingdom of the Elves. The people of this area will be much taller and thinner, with larger eyes. I can't make them take to the trees, but I plan to encourage them with the financial incentives. I know the elves will be a bit too far away to enjoy on a regular basis, but marbled throughout the Kingdom of Man, there will be occasional pockets of hobbits to work the farmland and generally add local color. In the final phase, Scotland, being quite mountainous, will of course be home to the dwarves.
Jimmy lowered his pointer and radiated smugness while everyone else tried to fully comprehend everything he'd said. Finally, the thick, velvety silence was broken by Eddie.
Remember when I said that he tells me everything? I was mistaken.
Philip said,
so what happened at Rickard's Bend, then? Something go wrong with your hobbits?
Jimmy sucked at his teeth, then said,
yes, regrettably. My encounter with Tyler left me so shaken that I accidentally skipped a step in their transformation plan, and, well, y'all know what happened then. Anyway, it was a most unfortunate accident, and I certainly don't blame Tyler for it.
Martin rubbed his eyes and took a deep breath.
He doesn't understand, he thought. He honestly does not get how wrong he is.
Philip cleared his throat and finally, for the record, said,
Jimmy, you're a bastard.
Jimmy seemed more confused than insulted.
This trying to improve life for everyone make me a bastard, Philip?
Yes,
Philip shouted.
If you don't give them any choice, it does.
Jimmy said,
well, Philip, if you want to eat a hamburger, you have to kill a cow. If you want to make a chair, you have to kill a tree. I want elves and hobbits, and I haven't killed anyone to make them, deliberately. I do feel very bad about Rieger's Bend.
Good,
Philip said.
You should! But even if you hadn't killed an entire village, you'd still be wrong. What if all of these people you're helping don't want to be dwarves and elves, Did you ever think about that,
Jimmy rolled his eyes as if he thought Philip was being terribly silly.
Philip, of course they won't want to become mythological creatures at first. Change is always scary. Once they see what they've gained, they'll change their minds. When the dwarves start pulling up all that gold that I'll keep magically feeding into their minds, when the hobbits find out that life in Hobbiton is like a perpetual Oktoberfest held in Amsterdam,
When the elves start to notice that they have a lifespan of hundreds of years, though, actually, I'll probably have to tell them about that up front. The point is, they're all getting something in return.
But they weren't given a choice,
Philip said.
You took that upon yourself, and you chose to murder over 100 people and endangered... Well, I'm not sure. How many people have you endangered?
Jimmy thought.
If you're referring to the experimental villages I've modified as a proof of concept, there are two more. That brings me to the next point. When Tyler reacted so badly to my hobbit village, I knew I needed to speed up certain parts of the process so I could really show you what I'm trying to do. Look, I know you're planning to exile me and cut me off. I have the right to a proper defense. All I ask is that you all come with me and let me show you my work. I promise you won't regret it.
Jimmy took his staff in hand, lifting it so the glowing blue plasma ball was slightly above head height, and offered his shoulder to Philip. Philip grimaced, then put a hand on Jimmy's shoulder. Jimmy looked to Martin, who followed suit, and in a moment, everyone in the room was linked. Jimmy said,
"Regardless of how this all comes out, I want to thank all of you for trusting me, huh? Transporto al Arimio Post Alpha!"
As soon as they heard that, every wizard in the room regretted having trusted Jimmy. The wizards appeared in an empty field just outside Camelot's fortified golden walls. The sky was still bright and clear. The sun was still blindingly bright, reflecting off of the golden city wall, which they were facing. Behind them was about a half mile of open field with forest on the far edge. Between them and the wall were at least 500 soldiers. They were standing at attention, wearing golden chainmail, rows and columns of them stretching off to both sides and back into the distance until the last row of soldiers stood with their backs to the wall. They were all quite tall, and their skin had an ashy blue pallor. Jimmy took a single graceful step that covered the 40 or so feet between the wizards and the soldiers. He landed lightly and spun theatrically, his arms stretched wide. His green and gold robe swirled around him. He waved his staff over the heads of the soldiers with a flourish.
"Feast your eyes upon the king's fearsome army of orcs!"
Jimmy bellowed in triumph. The various wizards said various things under their breath, but Philip summed up their feelings with a single word.
"Crap!"
Jimmy spun around again to look at his handiwork, turning his back to the wizards.
"I know, right?"
he said, putting his left hand on his hip and leaning heavily on his staff.
"That chainmail is real gold, you know. Took me forever to produce all those little gold rings."
Martin was straining to process the full meaning of everything he saw. Some part of his mind gave up and decided to just take all of the problems one at a time. He was a bit surprised to hear himself yell,
"You can't make armor out of gold! It's too soft! An axe will go right through it!"
Jimmy looked back over his shoulder at Martin, and for a moment he looked concerned. Then he shrugged and said,
Oh well, I can always make more.
Gwen asked,
"More gold rings or more soldiers?"
"Either,"
Jimmy answered.
"And please, call them orcs."
"No, never! They're not orcs, they're not!"
Philip shouted.
"Well, not yet. To be honest, they're only about 10% of the way to their final form. I don't dare change him any faster."
Philip motioned to the soldier nearest to him.
"Yo, step forward."
The soldier lumbered forward. He was at least a foot taller than Jimmy, and his movements were slow and deliberate.
"They're still adjusting to their new size,"
Jimmy explained.
"Show me your teeth."
The soldier bared his teeth, large slabs of yellowed calcium with livid red gums, and more than a little blood gathered in the spaces between the teeth.
"It's quite painful, unfortunately. Not just because of the growth, either. As they get used to their new teeth, I'm afraid their cheeks and tongues take quite a bit of abuse. I deaden their pain receptors to compensate. As an added bonus, they know that if I'm unhappy, the pain comes back. Keeps them obedient."
Jimmy turned back to face the wizards, spreading his arms wide.
"Well, what do you think?"
Philip said,
"It's inhuman."
Jimmy said,
"Yes."
"No,"
Philip said.
This, Jimmy! This is inhuman. This is the worst thing ever. Even I didn't think you were capable of this. Jimmy, you have to stop. You have to change them all back.
Oh, Philip, I can't do that. If I did, all my hard work would be wasted.
Philip didn't shout, but his voice had a hint of madness to it.
Jimmy, you will undo everything you...